welcome to the Tree Planners Podcast. It is October 2022, and that means it's several months after our last episode.
We're still here.
Yeah, we're still here. As usually happens, the summer kind of distracts you, I guess, in lots of pleasant ways. And now the leaves are turning. Actually, there's an explosion of color outside, which is beautiful. But it won't be too long before that explosion of color is rotting on the ground and then covered by frost.
And don't rake them. Don't bother. It's better for the grass and everything else just to leave them. So just take the lazy man's route and just leave them for the earth's health.
Yeah. I mean, or you can rake them into a big pile so your kids can jump in them.
That's fun. We used to do that. Now the kids are older where they're just like, I feel like they're old enough to help rake. And I'm like, oh, we can rake them and then you can jump in them. They're like, that's a lot of work. So I'm like, you're right.
Yeah.
So leaving them on the ground it is.
Well, you know, like all good things, I don't know. I actually entirely agree with this, but like all good things, takes a little bit of work.
That's true.
But anyways, Adam here, and that other voice you're hearing is Margaret, of course. How you doing, Margaret?
I'm doing well. This is our special election rant podcast.
Yeah, we're mostly going off the cuff as we usually do. We've got a couple of things we want to talk about. But why don't we always forget this, or if we don't forget it, we leave it till the end, but why don't we do a couple of public, notices, I guess, or whatever. We are largely supported by, contributions. So we get funding from, you know, foundations, we make applications for grants for work that we do. And we also rely to a large extent on the support of people like you. Hopefully you can donate to us on our website, but also, and this is new news, you can donate using the Small Change Fund, which is this fantastic organization that allows nonprofit organizations, which we are, to accept donations and also issue a charitable receipt. And we are not a charity, and there's reasons for that. And maybe we can get into that. I mean, we're actually sort of having this. I mean, there's a little bit of crossover there with the municipal election and messaging and things like that. But we really do rely on your support. So if you like what we do, or if you're curious about what we do, please visit our website. You can see a lot more. There's also offshoot initiatives that we do. One of them is Community Leaders for Sustainable Simcoe, which we'll be talking about more today. The shortened form is CLASS. And another is Just Recovery Simcoe, or JRS. Mm-hmm. And you can Google both of those websites as well and get a better sense of what we do. Mm-hmm. So did I miss anything in the pitch? Is there more to pitch?
No, just that people would support us. The people that would support us are people that are concerned about climate, concerned about democracy, concerned about building a better, equitable world, but looking for people that are laser focused on not only long-term strategy, long-term game, but the actions that will get us where we need to go, right? There's there's whole discussion about, are we doing enough for climate? I think this is where some of the frustration comes at the federal level or even the provincial level or global level. And we're always pushing for the enough and trying to build changes in systems so that the enough is also politically possible, right? So that's that's kind of what our whole shtick is, I would say. And we have a very large coalition building kind of that social power. So that is our kind of ethos. That's how we do what we do, why we do what we do. And this just happens to be one way we communicate with you. So yeah.
Mm. Yeah. It made me think, and I'm going to move on a little bit from the picture, because nobody wants to listen to people, ask for money for too long. But it made me think a little bit. So you mentioned a few things there that people wouldn't typically associate with an environmental organization, such as social justice, improved accountability and democracy and things like that. And this has been on my mind for a while. I recently started doing TikToks for mm-hmm. our Central County Greenbelt Coalition account, which I have, I'm not entirely sure I'm super happy doing anything on TikTok, but whatever.
You were forced. Let's just make that clear. No,
I wasn't forced. It is kind of fun. I'm also a little bit leery of that organization. But anyways, the specific subject that I was thinking of focusing on for this TikTok was, what is an environmentalist? What does that mean? And there's a lot, it's a pretty loaded term for good reasons. There's been a lot of effort put into putting it in a box and which allows it to be controlled and manipulated and marginalized. And there is actually evidence, there's a history of a concerted effort made to marginalize that term as an environmentalist. But there is also sort of a lot of pro bono work, if you will, done by people who call themselves environmentalists who have contributed to that marginalization. Mm-hmm. And I think I love etymology. I love breaking down words and looking at their origin and what they mean in their most basic and simple form. I think it's really useful for understanding them, for understanding the language that we speak, which goes also quite a long way to being able to understand the world around you. In its most basic, an environmentalist is somebody who is concerned with what is around them, with their environs, right? With their surroundings. And there's so much that goes into that, mm-hmm. right? I mean, you could be somebody who's obsessed with something like feng shui, which I'm not personally. I do find it important to pay attention to my home and to where things are positioned so that they feel good and things like that. And maybe that's feng shui. I don't know enough about it. So that's why I'm not really obsessed with it. But as an example, I mean, that in a sense is an environmentalist, somebody who's concerned or somebody, who's concerned with their community, whatever that might happen to be, if that's people in their neighborhood, if that's people who share an interest, these sorts of things. Anyways, I'm getting long-winded, which is what I tend to do. But an environmentalist, there are those crossovers, right? There's a fluidity to the term that kind of transcends boundaries. It isn't right. just simply interested or focused on trees or wildlife or water mm-hmm. or things like that, right? Yeah. Because all of those things quickly then sort of spill over into other things.
Yeah.
So that in sort of a roundabout way to explain, why we have those interests in all of those different areas, which also made me think about, and this I'm going to hook up a little bit with the municipal election, some webinars that we recently helped to organize for CLASS, for Community Leaders for Sustainable Simcoe. There were three of them, and we'll get to all three of them, but the one in particular that I'm thinking about is the Protecting Water webinar. Then we had you, Margaret, on there mm-hmm. as a panelist. We also had Claire Malcolmson of the Rescue Lake Simcoe Coalition. And we had Mike Balkwell of the Water Watchers, formerly known as the Wellington Water Watchers. And these three webinars were specifically targeted towards people who are running in the upcoming municipal election in Ontario, October 24th. So the goal was to give them sort of a solid foundation of understanding of water issues at the municipal level. But it's a really interesting topic because water is fluid. It doesn't adhere mm-hmm. to those political jurisdictions easily, right? It'll flow across them. And so there has to be a a way of working together, a way of communicating and collaborating across those sort of strict political lines. So it's a really interesting thing to work on politically. Yeah. And in Ontario, we've got some really fantastic organizations that are sort of meant to sort of explicitly transcend those political boundaries because they're established on watershed basis, which are the conservation authorities. So it's an interesting, I don't think that was a topic that was getting into very much on the webinar, but it's nevertheless, it's an interesting subject when you think about the marriage of environment and politics. And which, the other two.
Which has been an uncomfortable marriage, let's put it.
Yeah.
Almost like we're just about ready to divorce, but we're going to stick together for the kids kind of marriage. Like we're going to pretend that this is all hunky dory and working fine, but I don't know. It's been in a very, I'd say probably more acrimonious than working well together. And to your point, environmentalism has been put in this like little box, and similar to feminism or other things, other causes more aimed at kind of like changing systems thinking has been put into a little box. And so part of this webinar was to show how difficult it is. You know, some of the leaders wanted us to just say, well, how do we fix our water problems? Like, give me three things that I can do. And the three things that they want, like upgrade your sewer systems or, you know, bill better at the water. Like, you know, just they want very direct, finite things that are going to fix everything. And then when you start to get into the conversation and you realize how it transcends not just your environmental policies, but also it, you know, you're starting to get into your housing policy and your food policies, and you're starting to get in how, you know, transportation and land use, like it really just can't be contained. And there's a lot of resistance to that. So that was a part of the rationale behind these webinars. It was to show the intersectionality that environment isn't just, like you were saying earlier, trees. And I have people say to me, oh, you're an environmentalist. You're like a tree hugger, right? I'm like, no, I really like trees and I do hug trees the odd time when it gets to me. But municipalities and municipal leaders and all political leaders want to say, oh, you're someone who only cares about the environment, only cares about the natural world, and therefore you cannot be pragmatic and appreciate concerns of housing or concerns of social justice, because really you're putting all of that above everything else. And it's kind of that those binaries again, right? You either do this or you do that. You can't do them both. And that's what the webinars also were trying to show, is that there are co-benefits to having proper housing policy, because if you do it in a proper way, in a thoughtful way, you can actually help with climate. You can help with affordability. It doesn't have to be an either or.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the other two webinars were, well, there was one focused on affordable housing with representatives from Barry Housing, which is a social, like the Social Housing Corporation for Barrie, nonprofit housing, and Kevin Eby, who was formerly a planner of the region of Waterloo, and Robert Chickendance, who's a builder and also past president of the Ontario Home Builders Association. I found that webinar to be fantastic. It really made me think, changed the way I think a little bit, and which is always good, I think. And there was also supporting local agriculture webinar. So all of those can be found on our YouTube channel and the class website as well, which is SimcoeCommunityLeaders.ca. Mm-hmm. So
are we ready for the rant part? Because I'm dying for a rant. No, I'm just
kidding. Okay, yeah. Well, no. Go for it. I've got a couple of points that I'll move on to at some point. But yeah, if you want to.
No, I'm just kidding. I'm always up for a rant. I mean, but I can pull them out of my sleeve pretty easily. But I wanted to just build on the municipal election part, because this is supposed to be our municipal election rant podcast. I don't know how much rants we're going to get into. But I wanted to remind people that this will be out before the 24th of October, I'm assuming, and to remind people just how important municipal elections are. one of the things Adam and I kind of groan about, and if you've listened to any of our podcasts, you've heard one or both of us talk about how we're so focused on global and national interpretations of climate change, and we haven't really thought about how it's very local and it's very specific and very relevant to our communities, to our homes, to our water sources. And instead of bemoaning and getting upset and sad, although, I mean, those are all reasonable responses about global issues that you feel you have very little power over, municipal elections is a place where you can have some power to change the political process and the leaders that are kind of making these really big decisions about where roads go, where they don't go, what kind of housing is provided, what kind of housing isn't provided, where is that housing provided, you know, what kind of safety is in your community, how do seniors and children and how are their public spaces for all these different types of people. And it's more than just garbage collection and road maintenance. And that's what people tend to think with municipalities, where there's a very large opportunity to have, you know, you've probably heard before, if you listen to our podcast, that, you know, 50% of Canada's greenhouse gas emissions are linked to municipal decisions. So October 24th is a time when you can put people into your local municipality and push them to be thinking about social justice, push them to be thinking about transportation and transit and climate action, which are all intertwined, right? Which is why with the Community Leaders for Sustainable Simcoe, we came up with a pledge. It's been signed by over 60 municipal candidates. I think we have almost every municipality in Simcoe County has at least one candidate that has signed on, and we have actually quite a few mayors and deputy mayors. It's not a perfect system because, you know, there's always a little bit of cynicism within politics, like, oh, they can say anything they want and then do anything that they want later. But that's kind of the point, is you hold them to something, you make them publicly admit or publicly support something, and then that's how you hold them accountable. If you don't raise the threshold of the values that they're supposed to uphold, and you just assume, like, oh, I'm going to vote somebody in and I'm going to make sure that they are thinking this way, but then don't follow up to be accountable, like, it kind of falls apart. So the pledge is not only just for municipal leaders, but it's also for the people that are voting to say, if this is what you're publicly declaring you support, I'm going to make sure that to help you, to keep you honest with these kind of things, because it's for the betterment for all of us. So you can go onto the Community Leaders website and see the signatories. And if you have zero candidates in your area that are on the pledge, then I would ask them, why haven't they signed the pledge? Sometimes it's just a matter of time. It's very busy to be a municipal candidate. They don't get a lot of help usually. It's usually mom and pop kind of situations. But, you know, it gives a good tool to separate the wheat from the chaff, if you will. And yeah, that's what I would suggest. That was it wasn't a rant, but I mean, that's as good as I'm going to do off the cuff.
Well, I think so. And if you do go and read that pledge, you'll notice that a lot of it is very process oriented. So talking about transparency, accountability, you know, evidence-based decisions and things like that. And for me, I think that's, it's been on my mind a lot with the increasingly polarized politics that we're experiencing in our society, which really does a disservice to the need for a good process in terms of decision-making, because you'll get people, and there's a candidate in Barrie that I've been supporting. I've been doing some canvassing and stuff like that. And at the door, when I'm asked why I'm supporting them, that'll sort of be what I go to. I've noticed them really sort of think carefully about what they've heard on a particular issue. And when they then speak about how they've arrived at a decision on that issue, it'll be clear that they have thought carefully and given a lot of consideration to the different viewpoints that they've heard on it. Mm-hmm. Rather than just simply jumping to sort of their preferred position on it, which often mm-hmm. is sort of a biased position, right? Mm-hmm. And so this is what we, and I think it's a real shame because this is increasingly what characterizes our political leadership, where you have people who were kind of just go to those places of bias far too easily, or those places where they think it'll be advantageous to be, which is part of the political game. I grant that, right? You identify which way the winds are blowing. Like part of your success as a politician is identifying the direction that the winds are blowing and getting there sort of before anybody else, kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
Fine. But that also leaves out that value of process. And frankly, like, process is what makes a good decision. If you have those well-established steps that you take in your consideration mm-hmm. of a particular issue, okay, you know, there, this happens and these will be the consequences of that. Can we ameliorate those consequences, you know, or what co-benefits might those consequences have, or whatever, right? You walk through the issue in this sort of careful and deliberate way, and you use that process to arrive at your decision. That's what we want from politician.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, you know, we're seeing less and less of that. And we need more and more of it, in particular, as we have an era kind of emerging upon us that has greater instability in it. And that includes climate risks. It includes, we see that with political risks and all that sort of thing. So what you want is a focus on that process. So that's, I guess, kind of why we tried to emphasize that in the pledge. And mm-hmm. I think hopefully anyways, you know, the candidates that have signed up to support the pledge, are serious about it. You know, it's not just mm-hmm. about getting a little bit of extra, recognition or publicity, but
yeah,
check it out.
Well, I think that it's important for people to know that a part of the process with them signing the pledge is that it's meant to be a supportive educational network that SCGC is going to continue to mm-hmm. nurture, right? That it's not just you sign the pledge and we'll see you in 4 years. These are going to be potentially the people, if they get onto council or even if they don't, that could help shift to better decisions. And I'll just say about the process part, because process, I have a love-hate relationship with. I think when I hear you speak, what it says to me is we want people that are considerate of different things in their process. But I find sometimes municipalities and governments in general mm-hmm. defer to, we followed a process. We came to a really shitty outcome, but we followed the process. And I think when we're looking on the spectrum of whether what we're doing to fix a particular problem, let's say climate, whether we're doing enough versus what we're doing politically possible, the processes, the formal processes that are in place are really meant to support what's politically possible and almost hardly ever are at the we're doing enough spectrum, mm-hmm. right? So for yeah. me, there's two parts of it within the pledge. You'll see that there's a consideration of what goes into your decision-making process, right? Are you going to consider climate? Are you going to consider, you know, the plight of poor people or ones that are struggling? Are you going to consider how you redo transportation? But also, are you going to start thinking about a process that may not be reinforced by political decisions currently, right? That are you going to start thinking of other things? Like, how does this particular decision impact the health and well-being of people in the community? I mean, we've been so focused on outcomes and GDP for so long at the expense of people, more and more people, at the expense of our environment, the expense of our own health that it's become just routine to say, this process says we should build here because we've looked at all these policies. It doesn't conflict with any of these policies. And therefore, this is a good decision because the process. So I just wanted just to bring in that nuance there, that there's a individual process we want them to go through to be considerate of things outside of it, but also to challenge the processes that are in place to say, did this really come to a good decision when you factor in that larger environment, like you're talking about, Just Recovery Simcoe considers, you know, the framework that we set up with those people, those organizations, is that a good decision at the municipal level simultaneously invests in nature, invests in community, and invests in people. That's what a good decision looks like, right?
Well, and focuses on the social determinants of health, which we really built that platform around. And community leaders as well borrows a lot from that. I guess what I would say to that is, I guess, like, the question I would have is, what process did you use to establish the process? Was it a good one or was it a bad one? But anyways, you can just keep on going back that way, I guess. And
you got to start somewhere, right? Yeah. Like, we just found out with the Bradford bypass that the Impact Assessment Agency has written to us through some freedom of information requests that we did, that when they considered the highway, whether it would be a project that they should intervene on or not, they didn't consider cumulative impacts to water and they didn't consider climate change. They don't factor those into whether they should be involved in a decision at all. So there is an example of a process that's flawed that they can adhere to say, we followed the process, but there's massive pieces missing out of the calculus, right? Like, how do you not change this? So there's a need in change in systems, and the way that Adam and I and the board and SCGC and the kind of the groups that we align with, most of them think, is that we have to start where we are, and where we are is in our community. And we start working together and snowballing the amount of people that say, hey, we can actually make better decisions that make our communities healthier, affordable, more socially connected, better for the young and the old. And we can do all this at once. And we're so, it's amazing to me that when I talk to people about this, they're like, that's impossible. That's impossible. There's no way that you can make a decision that meets all of those things at once. And we've been trained for so long to think in binaries. It's going to be good for something, but bad for something. There's always going to be a win-lose, right? Always going to be something is going to have to be sacrificed in order for us to get to a good decision. And what usually ends up happening, it's the welfare of people, it's the welfare of our planet that gets sacrificed because we figure those other decisions that are quote unquote good for us will make up for the fact that we've been sacrificed, if you will, right? But they don't. And we're finding that now. All those decisions that were supposed to be good for us aren't really that good for us.
Yeah. So I've got a couple of things I wanted to talk about in terms of specific, like a particular issue that I think people need to look out for, that their candidates might be using in their messaging. Is there something you wanted to get onto before, like now, or?
No, you go for it. I'll follow up with my rant afterwards if you so inspire me.
All right. So this is also sort of borrowing a little bit from a recent TikTok that I did, which was talking about the messaging that a lot of candidates really like to do come election time, which is that I will not raise taxes or I'll lower taxes or whatever.
Freeze them, whatever. Yep.
Yeah. This is one of the claims that I think you need to be quite skeptical about. It's one thing to say, I'll be careful, like, and, you know, pay, like, we'll try and minimize waste and be efficient. And if you've listened to Margaret and I talk at all about, municipal planning, you'll know where we go with efficiency and waste, which generally has to do with sprawl and how we use, resources. But it's another thing entirely to sort of make that flat out, I will not raise taxes or I will lower taxes or whatever. And the reason for this is that there are a number of spending pressures in Ontario, specific to municipalities that are current and that are only going to increase in the coming years. So specifically what I'm talking about is infrastructure and then infrastructure deficit, which is north of currently north of $50 billion. This is from a study that the Financial Accountability Office of Ontario came out with just a couple of years ago. Ontario's municipalities currently, they sort of oversee infrastructure with a replacement value, which is kind of how they estimate the cost of the worth of it, of just shy of $500 billion, half a trillion dollars. So about a tenth of that is in backlog. So, which means that they, to bring it up to a state of good repair, that's, you know, they need to spend money to do that. And this isn't sort of the current maintenance, right? So there's money being spent on current maintenance, but this is stuff that is just slipping through the cracks. And that is, and that has a value of just over $50 billion. So that in itself already is telling you that there is, there's pressure on municipal revenues to maintain the quality of life that we have come to expect in municipalities. So this will sort of get onto a point of how we think that could be achieved. But I'll catch up to that in a little bit, because I'm just going to double down on this spending pressure that municipalities are going to encounter and why I think these claims of not raising taxes are I don't know, cheap. Is there better? There's probably a better adjective.
But I would just say that they can't afford it. There's no municipality in Simcoe County that can afford to not raise their taxes, as well as keep their services at the current level, keep their road services at the current level, continue to provide services for new communities that they're developing, as well mm-hmm. as, you know, focus on whatever sort of adaptation and mitigation they're doing for climate change. There's zero municipality yeah. in Simcoe County. I can say that very, very, they can't afford it. Nobody can. Yeah. So anyways, I'll throw that back to you.
Yeah. So the question then is like, well, so where are they going to find the revenue? Either they're going to let these, the state of good repair totally sort of lapse, get away, and we're going to be driving on roads strewn with potholes, or, you know, where are they going to find the money? What are they going to cut? But this, as I mentioned, only grows as we sort of project outward into the future. And in particular, this is because of climate impacts that we're going to experience. So another recent study, even more recent, by the FAO, the Financial Accountability Office, looked at how climate is going to impact specifically transportation infrastructure in Ontario. So with a stable emissions scenario, we're looking at an extra, the maintenance with a stable emissions scenario is just about $13 billion per year, adding up to $1 trillion by 2100. In a medium emission scenario, we're adding 2.2 billion to that 13 billion. So an additional 171 billion to that 1 trillion. And then in a high emission scenario, it's plus 4.1 billion. So what's that? 17 billion additional per year. That's adding up to another 322 billion. So $1,322 billion per year that we'd be spending maintaining public transportation infrastructure. So these are things like roads, bridges, culverts, you know, transit as well. And the reason for this with climate impacts, so with roads, extreme rainfall will increase erosion and washouts. Extreme heat will increase the risks of cracks forming. Bridges, a lot of the same. And, you know, you go down the list and there's a number of ways that extreme heat
Well, just like what happened to Coca-Cola, right? Like out in BC, mm-hmm. like all of, there's so many already examples in mm-hmm. Phoenix. Was it this summer or last summer? It was so hot they couldn't get planes off the tarmac. Like, mm-hmm.
oh yeah.
And what's happening in the States is that municipalities or counties, similar to the structure that we have, are saying we can't actually afford to maintain the roads that we've built. So they're doing what they call road diets. They're ripping up roads because they don't have they don't want the liability. They can't afford the liability of it, but they can't also afford to maintain and operate them. And I'll say that there's two municipalities in Simcoe County. There could be more, but I know there was two studies done on two municipalities in Simcoe County that showed that they don't know how that most of their roads are in disrepair, like over 60%, and they don't know how they're going to be able to pay for it. Both rural municipalities, okay, not Barrie, although I don't think Barrie's necessarily their roads are in great shape either. But what ended up happening was there was this promise, we're going to pave more roads to make it better for you to drive on. And now they're like, oops, that's a lot of rural roads that we have to now maintain and operate that we don't know how we're going to pay for it. Mm-hmm. So what do we do? And if people think that's a United States thing, the road diet thing wouldn't happen here, it is happening in parts of Canada. So
yeah, well, and that gets to, I think that gets to where we go with how municipal leaders can address this issue, right? So that is you're spending money. So those build outs of roadways that enable people to hop in their car at the end of their, or you know, just outside their door in their driveway, get in their car, like I did this morning, drive several kilometers to the nearest grocery store, do their grocery shopping, drive back to their house. So I live in a suburban area, and there's a lot of roads required to support that, which are, as we've just pointed out, going to be increasingly expensive for municipalities to maintain. If you've listened to us, you've heard us talk about the need to develop our communities more efficiently, and that you're minimizing the impact that you are having on the land while simultaneously maximizing the use of the resources that you're building, mm-hmm. such as roadways, which can be utilized far more efficiently for transit if they're more dense developments and complete communities. You can also have more active transportation like walking and bicycling and things like that. So you're maximizing the potential revenue generation and minimizing the,
liability, really.
Not minimal, but you're minimizing the amount of expense per mm-hmm. square surface area that you're needing to spend. So that really is something that should be a focus of municipalities all over Ontario and in Canada as well, thinking about how we can be far more efficient in using the resources that we build with.
Yeah. Yeah, we should actually call it this section, municipal leaders, red flags. What are the red flags? If they come to you and say that they're going to freeze taxes or not raise taxes, I would say that's a red flag. How do they actually plan on making services better? How do they plan on maintaining the service level? How can you afford it? You know, we get into these questions of, it seems like whenever there's a social good, right, we're going to we're going to preserve a certain spot. We're going to invest in anti-poverty kind of strategies. We're going to build homes for people that are struggling, whatever. There's always this question of how can we afford this? How are we going to pay for this? And it's amazing to me that we never get that same question. So that's a good red flag. I would say, I'm going to add to this segment that we didn't plan to the red flags. If someone says to you, you know, we have to balance the needs of the environment with our economy, I think that somebody who sees the environment and the economy as a binary, just like you would on the scales, right? It's either, you know, we have to balance the two because they're not the same, they're not intertwined. You can boost your economy, but you're going to have to sacrifice a little bit of the environment. And if you boost the environment, you have to sacrifice your economy. And there was a study done, it must have been at least 10 years ago now, of some of the northern states. And they showed that the states that had the highest environmental regulations also tended to have a higher level of GDP growth and like attraction of businesses to those states. So this whole thing, so that would be my red flag. Another one, if they talk anything about, well, we got to balance the needs, or, you know, we got to take care of the environment, but, which I've taught my kids now, when you say a but, whatever came before it is basically you've just null and void it. And that's really not what you mean. Everything you say after the but is what you mean. So we need to take care of the environment, but the economy is a priority. What they actually wanted to just say to you was the environment is the priority. and show you and trying to be nice about including the environment in it so that you feel that they are a safe candidate. And I would say that's a red flag.
Well, yeah, I mean, and there's a number of really simple examples. I mean, I guess I'd be interested in that study and the data that they used. Like, it's for me that the first question that I ask is, you know, the chicken or egg question. Do they have better environmental protections because they were, you know, more sort of industrially successful early on and can afford those environmental protections, or you know, mm-hmm. what have you, who knows? But that aside, we know that there's a number of things that are environmentally friendly that have economic co-benefits, you know, bike lanes and walkable communities, particularly in commercial areas, are mm-hmm. environmentally friendly and economically friendly. There's a ton of data out there that shows that businesses in those areas benefit quite dramatically.
Yep. Yeah.
And you know, you can go in a bunch of ways with that. You know, more walkable communities also reduces health expenditures because you have a healthier population. Et cetera. But yeah.
Do you have another red flag?
Yeah.
Do you?
Yeah. Oh, okay, do I have another red flag?
Yeah. I have one if you don't have one.
Well, yeah, I guess I mean, it's sort of along the lines of what we've just been talking about, but those just a simplistic assertion like that, a simplistic statement, to me indicates that they are, and this goes back to this individual that I'm supporting, on the campaign trail a little bit where I can,
as an individual, by the way, not as SCGC, I'll just make it clear before anybody right. starts.
Yeah. Well, and that's also why I've been careful to not gender or name or anything like that. But, I've seen change their decision on something when given better information on that. And that flexibility, to me, it's not so much bending with the wind. I guess it is a little bit, but that better information component is really important. Mm-hmm. And being able to understand what good information is, which gets back to that process part for mm-hmm. me.
Yeah,
not all information is good information, people. Being able to change and respond to the circumstances as they may arise is important. I mean, that's what I think that's what we want. We don't want an inflexible, brittle, ideological person in charge of running, you know, a large organization that has a lot of influence over our lives. So those simplistic statements that are made on campaign literature, such as the "I will not raise taxes," well, dude, for a lot of people, in instances where I've seen this, these are candidates that haven't even, they're not incumbents, right? They haven't even been in office yet. So why are you talking about this?
Or some of them have. There are some incumbents that are, no, that are going that. On yeah, that. I have had experience in government before.
And are saying that. Yep. but you know, what if something happens and you're backing yourself into a corner, and to me, that's just stupid. And so that's a big red flag.
Pay now or pay later is how I look at it. And some of the municipal finance.
We're not advocating for taxes here either, by the way, folks. We're just telling you, think about this stuff. You know, they're not being entirely honest or forthcoming with you if these are the claims that they're making, because there are these pressures. Mm-hmm. Sorry for cutting
and
you off.
And I would just say that there are people that could listen to this and say, actually, I would be fine if my taxes are lower, and I don't care if we still have libraries open, and I don't care if we're not able to give money to support social services, and I don't care if we're going to have a doctor relocation program, because likely they're in a situation where they're privileged enough where it's not going to be an immediate impact to them, right? There are going to be people that'll be like, oh, I don't care, like whatever, like who cares, lower my taxes, that's more important to me. But down the road, you're going to have to pay for it eventually. And I think that's something that everyone has to realize, is that you can't have it all. Just like your household budget, you can't spend all of your money and all the things you want and then pay off debt and also invest for the future. And also, a dollar can only go so far. And where they choose to allocate those funds and how they choose to spend their money shows you what their values are. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, there is possible to freeze taxes and lower taxes, but it doesn't come with the promise of everything's going to stay the same or even improve. It just can't. Mm-hmm. They just can't. The math isn't there. I would add another red flag, which is if you get into somebody, and this may, some of our listeners may not like this, but such is life. Another red flag I would say is when you ask someone about what their climate plan is, they are very focused on electric vehicles. Like, well, our plan is to get our fleet to electric vehicles by 2025, whatever it happens to be, and we're going to set up charging stations. Now, the caveat with this is that, yes, those things would be helpful, but we're moving again on that spectrum versus what is feasible versus what is enough, right? And if we look at the what is enough that municipalities need to be doing to lower their greenhouse gas emissions, an electric vehicle strategy will not be enough, not even close to it. And some of the greenhouse gas emission studies that have been done locally show that the municipality itself, meaning the trucks that it drives and owns and fire trucks or whatever, is a very, very small percentage of the total greenhouse gas emissions. So sure, electrify your fleet. Great. It's helpful, but it is so far away from enough, right? What actually municipalities need to be doing is shifting how people live in their communities by transit, walkability, right? So transitioning to less car dependence and walkable communities is in the end of enough, but it is not in all cases considered politically feasible. Because it requires a lot of system change and a lot of decisions that some people maybe ran on. You know, we're going to build this, and then they're like, oh, actually, if I move away from that identity as somebody who's got cranes in the air everywhere, you know, just development everywhere, and not thinking about what thoughtful, helpful development is, because there is such a thing. So that would be a red flag to me. Now, the only other thing I would add to this is with this one, I wouldn't say that necessarily means that they're a terrible candidate and you shouldn't put any energy into it. But what it shows to me is they have a very low understanding of what is actually required to do enough for climate locally as well as globally. And the only reason why I say they're not necessarily a junk candidate is because the public narrative and some environmental groups have been pushing electric vehicles so hard for so long, it has become this dominant thing. Like, as long as we have electric vehicles, we'll be able to be just as happy, just as successful, plus lower emissions. And it's just not true. The science, the data doesn't back that up. Mm-hmm. So we have to start getting honest about the shifts that we need to make at the community level. And I would say, start thinking about the places that you vacation. Start thinking about those places where you can take the train, or you get just a walk to go to the store, or all those places, whether it be a Wonderland or a Disney World, or you go to Europe, or you go to more, like you go visit Paris or wherever. you're probably going to be vacationing in places, even if you look at an all-inclusive, you're in a walkable community that you can get to anywhere within 15 minutes. So if you're curious about whether a walkable community, you'd be happy and relaxed and feel safe. It's not a utopia, don't get me wrong, but you probably have experience vacationing or living in a place that is that at some point, even if it was just for the day to go to Wonderland, right? Like there is a different feel to it. So yeah, you will be better off long-term, and the studies show that. So that's my other red flag, is I would be leery of someone who claims themselves a climate leader who then offers electric vehicles as the solution. It is the thing that the municipality is going to do.
Yeah. So there's a question I want to ask to wrap this up. But just quickly before I do, there's this really lovely and illuminating way of thinking about our communities and the way that we build them. And so it contrasts sort of the way that we do it for the most part here with our suburban neighborhoods, large houses, gated backyards or fenced in backyards and garages. Typically, you have to drive to get to your grocery store. Often you'll have parks kind of nearby. There's some amenities like schools and things like that usually are walkable. Although even so, we walk to school just about every day with my kids. But there's still a significant proportion of people that drive, even though, you know, it might be a 5 or 10 minute walk. They drive their kids still. But for the most part, I think in these areas, and this is probably pretty typical for communities across North America, the bulk of interpersonal activity happens within the confines of the private property, within the house or in the backyard or what have you there. You know, you get sort of that cross-pollination that happens in those parks and in those schoolyards and and on the streets with neighbors and things like that. But proportionately there, you know, it's far more time spent indoors or in the private space. But you look at where 15-minute communities happen and things sort of flip around on their heads a little bit. So you tend to get smaller indoor areas, smaller indoor private personal areas. But the outdoor public area is not necessarily larger, but more of it is devoted to that sort of social sphere, right? Mm-hmm. It's inhabited by residents as if it's part of their living space, an extension of their living space that they spend together with other residents.
Yeah.
And the social cohesion that results from that is valuable, or maybe invaluable. It's just something that's really precious. But I think there's also a number of indicators along the lines of sort of quality of life, happiness, and those sorts of things that indicate that makes for a better experience. Anyways, I think it's interesting to think about how that sort of we have sort of closed off, I guess, a part of our world with the way that we build in North America, largely. Anyways.
Was that the question? Was there a question? You said there was a question.
No. Well, yes. So the question is, and it has nothing to do with what I just talked about.
Oh, well, I wanted to add to that before. I was going to say you inspired that little talk, got me thinking about so we saw with COVID, there was an inequitable level of access to green space in nature, right? There were people that had big backyards, or they had forest behind them or green space and were able to get to it, places that had had few parks, you know, and they tend to be a socioeconomic link to that as well, right? The richer places had more access, the poorer places had less access. But I was thinking, if you looked at, say, Barrie, and you thought about public places, places where people dominated. Okay. So think about like a Wonderland, for an example, where it's primarily people either walking or rolling versus cars. And if you did like a Google map image and you took out all of the places that are dedicated to cars. So let's look at like, the Molson Park area, right? You took all of that parking lot out. You took all of the streets out. And then what are you left with for people places, right? Like little narrow sidewalks, a park maybe that's 20 kilometers away. Like, you know what I mean? Like there's, when you start to flip it to say, oh, this is what's left for you guys, then you're like, there's hardly anything left for us, right? There's some places in Barrie and other parts of Simcoe County that are better, but I would almost like to see it as a percentage, like here is this community and X percentage is what we would consider people places. And 88% of it is what we would consider car places. So, you know, that whole balance. And I think what we've been advocating for is less on the car dominated spaces and more on the people oriented spaces, right? Benches and lovely trees to sit on and ways that we were building for a very long time. People forget that this is how our communities, like the turn of the century, we're building this sort of style, and we've done it for a long time. And even in Europe, and which is why a lot of them look the way they do, because the car was well after they had established most of their city centers. Anyways, we just have to revert back to how we had communities before. This is a new social experiment that nobody's done before. So back to you. Yeah. There's a question.
Yeah. The question is, in 4 years' time, if, what would be a successful for you, a successful outcome of this election in 4 years' time?
I think that the first indicator for me would be the conversations sound different. I was talking to you about a book that I was listening to, because I can't technically say I read it because it was an audiobook, but whatever. I was listening to, and they were talking about how when you change systems, you're looking for shifts in paradigms, shifts in values, what people value and how they value. And they said, if you want to look at how malfunctional or how malfunctioning a system is, look at how the policies are made and who gets to make those policies and who is most impacted by those policies. That's where you'll see the malfunctions in the systems that we live in. So it's pretty, when you start to look at it that way, you're like, okay, who gets to make those decisions? Who isn't a part of those decisions? What are those decisions? Who do they impact the most? And who is considered valid in those decisions? So thinking about systems change and how we view things, I mean, a while ago, I would have said, we have climate emergency declarations, which I think falls under the politically feasible, but not nearly enough, because we have quite a few climate emergency declarations that never really went anywhere, right? In this region, it's still a status quo business as usual approach. So I would think success for me would be that we have brave political leaders that are talking about climate differently, are talking about communities differently, are really challenging how decisions are made and challenging that status quo of like, well, this does impact us because, you know, even though it's not in our municipal zone, it does impact us. And not only that, I would like to see that those leaders are supported, not maligned, not ostracized on council. I would love to see it across all Simcoe County, but I think that might be a little bit too much. But if I had any wish I could, that's what I would like to see, that how we talk about it, how we commune around it, and how we support those leaders has changed. What about you?
So I just wanted to quickly defend the climate emergency declarations slightly there's always this asterisk that I think needs to go next to a number of things that happened around that time, because the pandemic hit like very mm-hmm. shortly after all of that stuff. And there was quite a burgeoning climate movement. I mean, I can just think of the climate strikes happening. And with Greta Thunberg and there were a number of climate emergency declarations being made. And it did feel to me as if there was some ahead of steam building up there. But then the pandemic hit and everything was locked down. And who knows? I mean, it's a counterfactual. Maybe it would have happened anyways, but it does feel like that really took the mixed metaphors, the wind out of the sails quite a bit. For me, I've got a couple of things and there's two specifics that are kind of quickly building off of the affordable housing webinar, which I can't recommend highly enough. Go watch the recording. But ending exclusionary zoning is really key for a number of reasons that will really help with affordable housing and help with building the complete communities that we need. And so when we say complete communities and 15 minute communities, they're more or less interchangeable. A complete community is a place where you can live, work, and play all in the same space, in the same community, rather than having to commute to another community to do those things. And a 15 minute community is you're able to access basic amenities within 15 minutes. So 15 roughly minutes the same, a little bit of what?
A 15-minute walk, let's be clear, because if it's a 15-minute drive,
that's 15-minute Concorde flight.
Yes. A personal helicopter ride.
Yeah. So the ending exclusionary zoning and also ending parking minimums, which are an absurd and antiquated tool. I would really like to see a lot of support for car share programs, getting a percentage perhaps of parking allotted to car share so that people have access, and perhaps even sort of subsidized so that people have access to vehicles without having to own one. They're a huge expense. They're not needed. I mean, if you think about these things, they sit idle for most of the time, 90% plus of the time, they're just sitting there and you're spending money for that. So finding a way to share these incredibly expensive and fairly destructive things in a more efficient way would be really useful. And then sort of more generally, I'd really like to see, and I think this maybe goes a little bit to your point about tone, I'd really like to see more engagement from the municipalities and its various institutions with local civic sector, in particular sort of non-governmental organizations, community organizations, and things like that, and starting a discussion for how to start laying the foundations for enhancing the resiliency of our communities. So identifying and there's a really great sort of methodology that can be utilized with this, which is called the asset-based community development. Identifying sort of skills and assets that are present within communities, supporting those by sort of linking them, identifying them, linking them, networking them, making it possible for them to take action, to operate. But then also building up those capacities. So if climate impacts occur, communities are better able to respond to them on their own rather than having to seek outside help. So we know, for example, that the Canadian military is stretched in terms of responding to disasters. They've acknowledged it. They've said as much. And so we really need to start, like, in effect, kind of establishing a local climate core that is able to increase the resiliency of our community, of our communities, and the work that the municipality is responsible for in that regard. I mean, sort of as that sort of central organizer, but then also you know, taking those steps to make sure that our communities are more climate resilient and not contributing to the problem by reducing the environmental footprint of them. So, yeah, that's kind of where I'd go with that question. But we're
long-winded.
We overshot our hour, and we're going to wrap up. Mm-hmm. And hopefully we'll get back to our monthly schedule with this. I don't see why we wouldn't be able to. And next time we speak to you, we should have some results and on from the election, and probably have lots of thoughts on that.
Post-election rant podcast.
Yeah.
Although we won't get specific about candidates probably, but just more of where we see some hope. And I would just to finish my little piece is to say that I personally reject the cynicism that politics don't matter. It's not the only thing that matters, right? People get into this idea that, that politics is the only way to create change. It's not. But I really reject the idea that, you know, politics doesn't matter. Well, if that was the case, look at some of the political decisions that are happening around the world, right? Some of the political leaders that we have locally, provincially, nationally, globally, it does make a difference. It really does have a big impact on the general population, our environment, our future. So if you've never voted in a municipal election, that's okay. Go look up your municipality. You can check out our class pledge to see if there's any cross-reference there between candidates to try and make it a little bit easier for you. Some of them have online voting and telephone. Some of them don't. But October 24th is the date. And if you want to be someone who can do their little part, this is one little thing that you could do, is to try to elect better leaders who are going to help create the future that we know that we need, and to move us closer into the enough column versus the politically feasible column. And so I would just implore you to take it seriously, to get people to vote and support those candidates.
Yeah. And to make some choices for informed choices for positive leadership, visit communityleaders.ca, simplecommunityleaders.ca. Yep. And on that note, we'll say goodbye. We wish you a great weekend, although this might be out early next week. So have a great week, and we'll see you soon.